Sacramento.
Glory, glory, Sacramento. Glory, glory, Sacramento. The Republic marches on.
Roro with the goal.
Roro's going to take a shot. Oh, my, do you believe it?
Cameron Nwassa charging forward, looking for a team to strike on distance, and it rattles in! Cameron Nwassa, the Sacramento King!
That it was less about if and more about when Sacramento was going to join Major League Soccer. Well, folks, when is today? Your when has arrived.
Welcome back to Rise of the Republic. We are joined today by a very special guest, Evan Ream. He is a soccer writer in the great state of California, centrally located here in Sacramento. He has covered the Republic in various ways, dating all the way back to the very first game. And he is just a soccer scribe in general. And welcome to the show, man. I'm really glad you joined us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Richard. I really appreciate it.
So I want to just kick this off last night because there are some important things to talk about going on in the world right now, in the world of sports and the world of soccer. You know, maybe I'm not the best person to talk about them as someone who hasn't experienced things, and you could probably be in that category as well. But I do want to ask you about your experience last night, because I know that you went to a game that didn't happen.
Yeah, and I think I would put myself in that category as well. And yeah, so I was going to go cover the San Jose Earthquakes against Portland Timbers game because, you know, it's not like I'm doing anything else right now. So I applied for a press pass and got, you know, accepted, drove down. And, you know, right as I was about to go in through the medical check-in that they have, the guy just who was doing the check-in just came up to me and said, yeah, game's canceled. And I was like, oh, that's weird. Like, I wonder why. You know, of course, because I was just driving for 2 hours and I wasn't checking social media or what was going on. And I, of course, didn't check my email to see that the Earthquakes had emailed me. But, you know, of course, we all know what's happened now. And I was, you know, just trying to figure out some more information. So I went around, you know, talked to a couple people, I talked to some PR guys. And then we saw the Timbers staff leave the game. And I was like, you know, well, I was thinking to myself, you know, I wonder if we're going to be able to talk to anybody. Then I talked to an Earthquakes PR guy. And of course, I put on Twitter, you know, that because of the what's going on with the quarantine situation, we can't actually have any face-to-face conversations with any of the players, which makes complete sense. So I kind of just said, all right, well, I guess I'll drive home. And, you know, everyone who's listening to this, I'm assuming is familiar with the situation. But yeah, I mean, I don't really have anything to add about that. Just that, you know, there weren't games last night, and there's an obvious reason why. And if you don't know what that reason is, then check out what the players have to say, because they're using, you know, the biggest platform in the best way possible, which is, you know, to not play.
Yeah, absolutely. I am right there with you. Just to very, very briefly fill in, and I feel almost uncomfortable to give it such brevity, but I also would feel uncomfortable to give too many thoughts about the situation going on. But just to fill in briefly, because I feel like we should, or I should, it kind of started with the Milwaukee Bucks in the NBA, but players across multiple sports and multiple leagues, NBA, WNBA, MLB, MLS, have not been playing in the past 24 to 48 hours by the time this comes out, specifically in protest of the shooting of Jacob Blake. It's not obviously not just that, you know what I mean? It's been an accumulation that we've seen over the months and really over the years and really, really over, right, hundreds of years. But specifically the incident with Jacob Blake being shot in Kenosha by a police officer, that is the specific reason, as stated by the Milwaukee Bucks, part of the specific reason is of why this protest is happening now. And I don't want to pontificate and give my opinions other than my basic opinion that I feel like I have to give and that I should give and that I want to give, which is that Black Lives Matter and that we should always support players, because, I mean, players are people too. They're not just on your TV to entertain you. They go through very, very real things, and many players across many sports are obviously, you know, black or brown or any other, you know, any form of systematically oppressed people. You know, they live every facet of our society, including the ones that we look to for some joy in our lives. But the problem is, you know, it can't always be happy when tragedies are occurring around us.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, obviously I'm not trying to, you know, downplay the what was going on or anything like that. Just that, like, you know, me as a white man, I don't have the same experiences as these people. So I'm not the best person to listen to. So I'm, yeah, like, what, check out what they have to say, because they, that this is their lives, right? This is like a lived experience by somebody else in the same country that we live in. And so, yeah, for the, I totally agree with what you're saying. And I'm, yeah, I'm not trying to downplay it. I'm just saying, go check out their message. It's better and more important and coming from a more realistic place than what I could ever say. So,
definitely, 100% with you. I won't do anything else other than just suggest that if you're listening, I'm just, you know, I'm speaking to the listeners here, because I know that you're with me and with every, you know, with the players on this, of course. That if you want to learn more about what's going on, you know, go on Twitter, go on Reddit, go on, you know, go any news source that is you know, other than Fox News, I'd say, and you'll see hear directly from people that are, you know, a part of this movement, what's going on. Because, yeah, like you said, you know, I'm a very privileged individual, not a part of any minority. I'm as white and as privileged as they come, quite frankly. And I would recommend that if you want to learn more about this, that you go listen to the people that are directly involved in the message. And yeah, so with that, you know, imperfect transition, we can get back to soccer. I don't know. Let me ask you, you know, of course I don't think there'd be any reporting to be done here, but would you expect, is it possible that this could spill over to the USL?
You know, it wouldn't be fair for me to speculate, although I, you know, because I'm not the players, and of course USL is, you know, doesn't have the same sort of players union that MLS has, right? And the players have probably a lot more to lose. I said it's probably not fair to speculate, but I am already speculating. But yeah, I mean, the players have a lot more to lose, given that they're on, you know, lower salary contracts. They're a lot worse off, and there's not really a players union that's going to back them up, like you saw the statement that the MLS players union released. But I did notice, like last night, you know, I'm going through Twitter, scrolling down, just trying to get, you know, because I basically drove 2 hours to Avaya Stadium, stuck around for 30 minutes or so, and then drove 2 hours back. So I was kind of out of the loop. And so I was trying to, you know, read The Athletic and go on Twitter and see what was going on. And I was, you know, reading about all these game cancellations and all these protests. And I saw the statement that the Milwaukee Bucks gave, and I listened to Chris Webber and Kenny Smith. I saw their bits from inside the NBA. And, you know, right in the middle of all of that stuff was like a tweet from the USL that was like, Tulsa now up 3-2. And I thought it was funny, because it was like all this stuff's going on, and that there's still like the USL still playing games. And I don't know if they made a statement at all regarding what was going on, or if any players are talking about doing anything, but it was just like the only thing in my Twitter feed that actually had to do with soccer was USL. And so I don't know necessarily know if that's good or bad, or, you know, anything really. It's just, I just thought it was an interesting moment, I suppose.
Yeah, that's, you know, It's a good point, because, yeah, I you're right. I mean, I don't want to put you in that position of speculation, but I speculate all the time. I'm an opinion writer, so like my whole thing is speculation in a weird way. But I do feel like it is a lot tougher to, without a union, without the same type of money. it can be really hard. And I mean, it already appears from what I've seen and read in the NBA that the NBA is planning to resume the season. And you know, I from what I've read there as well, part of that could be linked to issues with the collective bargaining agreement, where, you know, basically some players have been advised that if this happens, you know, this could be, and, you know, lead to a lockout that could be years without salary. And it's it might be one thing if you're making $50 million and $30 million, whatever, $20 million, and it might be another thing if you're, you know, you're on the fringes of a league, or especially right now, like, people are going to be struggling more financially as well. So, and it's, and the fact that there's, you know, do you want to use that platform actively? You know, what's the more powerful message? Is it to walk away? Is it to stay and play? And, you know, this and this and this. So all I can say on that topic, and I don't mean to drag this out, but I will support the players in whatever their decision is, you know, whether that's to play, whether that's to take a break, whether that's, you know, to add, you know, additional messaging in a game, whatever it is. Yeah, that's all I know, is that I'm definitely going to be supporting the players no matter what.
For sure. It's a complicated world out there right now.
It truly, truly, truly is. So that's going from something definitely historic to, I wanted to go to a little bit, a different version of history. I read your piece on, I believe the burgeoning series, Republic Time Vault. I think you say potentially one single piece series, but you wrote about your experience at the very first ever Republic game, and I also read the piece you did for the B on that as well, on the Tower Bridge Battalion. Man, I mean, let me just ask how you got involved in that to begin with, and how you, like, ended up writing about the Republic at all.
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. And yeah, that the Republic Time Vault story is, you know, it's the first part of it, at least a one part series, or no, sorry. I don't know how many parts it's going to be, but it, you know, it's at least one. So, I did that one. You know, if people continue to read it, it got okay readership. You know, maybe I'll do some more. And it's kind of interesting to take a look back on, you know, games that happen, you know, now that we're into, geez, the sixth, seventh season. I can't do math. I know that 20 minus 14 is six, but never mind. Anyway. So yeah, I've been working for the Davis Enterprise for a little bit, in 2014. Right. And I was sort of sending out feelers, you know, because I've always been interested in covering a professional soccer team, right? And so I talked a little bit with the communication staff of the Republic, right? And I sent out some, you know, just some tweets or whatever. And I was like, hey, is this actually going to be well supported? And because I just really didn't know, you know, I hadn't been involved in, you know, watch parties in Sacramento. You know, obviously Davis is a very big soccer town itself, but I didn't know how big of a soccer town Sacramento would be. And I got contacted. I mean, I've been doing some stuff on soccer, and I got contacted by actually Marcos Bertone of the B, and he recommended me to the features editor at the time for the B, and they wanted to sort of write a piece introducing who the supporters group for Sacramento Republic was, and they recommended me. So, you know, I went over into one of their TIFO painting parties, and I met with them, and I was like, you know, like, this was cool, but it would probably be better if, you know, I think it was only like $50 to go on the bus with them down to LA and to get a match ticket as well. Although I end up, you know, as press just covering the game, but I was like, you know, it might be a cool trip. I really like to travel and I like to watch soccer. So I'm just gonna go do this. And, you know, there were probably about 50 of us and the game was all right, but I didn't really know what was going to happen when the team started playing its first home games. And I asked my editor at the Davis Enterprise, I said, would you be okay with me covering the Republic? You know, we don't really have, we mostly cover college sports and high school sports, and that obviously doesn't happen during the summer, and the Republic mostly play their season during the summer. So I figured that we could get, you know, with Davis being such a big soccer town, we could get pretty good coverage and people would be interested in it and they would want to read. And my editor said, you know what, it's a big thing to go to the first game and people are going to be interested in that. Like, the first game for any team should be covered, of course. But after that, I don't think really we're going to have the interest. So I said, okay. And then I went to the first game, and of course, Hughes Stadium sold out, which I think was 20,231 tickets. And I went, and it sold out, and it was an amazing atmosphere. The Republic lost 2-1 to Harrisburg, but also Davis native Adam John was playing for the Republic on loan from the Earthquakes at that time. And my editors sort of just saw, you know, what happened, saw the crowd, saw the buzz around the city, and we were like, yeah, you know what, go with it. So from then on, I covered the Republic through the, I want to say, 2017 season, before I had a conflict of interest because the youth soccer job that I worked for, my boss there was hired to be the assistant coach. So yeah, I covered the first 4 years, and now that my boss is no longer with the team, I'm back this year, and I've been really enjoying myself. So I guess it's a lot of something of a long-winded answer, but that's my story.
No, I want longer. I want, go back.
Okay.
I want to know. I mean, I just want to know. So like, how you got into soccer writing. Did you play, how long did you play? And then, you know, where did you go to school for writing? Like, when did you, cause I know as a journalist myself, like, often the path is strange and winding.
Yeah. So I didn't start playing soccer till I was 14. You know, I'm 5'10", right? And I was this tall when I was like 13. And so I was a basketball player, but you know, I was always one of the big men or whatever. And then I sort of just stopped growing, and that stopped being like a viable option to play me as like the four or whatever. So my brother was on this U19 soccer team, and I joined that as a 14-year-old when I was in like ninth grade. And that was like the first time I ever really played soccer, and I just fell in love with it, started playing. You know, I went to a tech high school, so we had laptops, and instead of paying attention to like the lectures or whatever, I would just be reading soccer articles like the whole time. And I was really well informed on like what was going on. I watched every single US national team game. I tried to watch almost every single MLS game every weekend. And then, you know, back then it was harder to get European soccer, but you know, maybe we would be able to get a friend to like tape an Arsenal game for us or whatever, and just try and, you know, follow the game that way. But I mean, so basically when I was in high school, all I did was read about soccer. And then I went to college in Oregon. I played on the club soccer team, and I, for whatever reason, ended up studying journalism. And I think what really got me into like covering professional soccer and, you know, going to stadiums, going to games, and just really living in that sort of lifestyle was, you know, I had to do like a capstone project in order to get my degree. And most people just kind of like mailed that in, or you could take a capstone class where everybody was going to write a series of articles on one thing. And it was a really guided process. And I was just like, you know what, I want to do something awesome. So I made a proposal to the journalism department that they accepted, in which my capstone project would be driving to 14 different MLS games across 12 different cities in the United States and Canada over a summer. It ended up being a 53-day trip that covered 13,500 miles. And I basically drove from coast to coast, and I didn't cover the games, I covered the fans. And I wrote about the differences between the supporters groups, and I met with people. I played pickup soccer. I learned about the different cultures of the different cities. And after that, I was just like, this is what I want to do. And these are the kinds of stories I want to cover. I don't want to actually write about, you know, if you've read any of my stories on my website, they're not really about the game. It's like what's going on around the game, the culture, the people. And so pretty much ever since then, I've been writing about the culture and the people surrounding soccer in the United States and occasionally Canada, and even more occasionally sometimes in Europe when I've been lucky enough to go there. So that's sort of sort of my story. I basically, since 2012, have just been going to games in any city, any country, any part of the world I can find, and been writing about them.
That's awesome. So you mentioned that Davis is a pretty big soccer town. And obviously you've been a part of witnessing what Sacramento is as a soccer city from the beginning. You know, how does it, I don't want to say stack up, but how does it, you know, compare or contrast to other, you know, other soccer cities that you've been to, that you visited, that you've witnessed firsthand? Like, what's unique about it? Or, you know, I mean, frankly, I guess the question is, how does it stack up? Because this is a city that's going to need to support an MLS team soon.
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting question. And because, of course, I haven't been to all the, unfortunately, I haven't been to all the MLS cities. I think I'm missing, like, in each year when they keep adding more expansion teams, my list keeps getting, you know, bigger and bigger. But I think I've been to all but maybe four or five of the cities in MLS. And I mean, Sacramento is interesting. Obviously, the fan support has been phenomenal in the USL, and it has been better than, you know, a lot of other teams that are, you're seeing success with in Major League Soccer in terms of fan support, right? I mean, like, even the Sounders were only averaging 4,000 people or whatever before they were in the, you know, in MLS. But that's just a different city, a different size, a different amount of other options in terms of professional sporting opportunities. And I mean, Sacramento, great fans. I mean, there's a lot of good talent coming from around the area. And the youth scene is pretty good. And I think it'll only continue to improve with, you know, once the Republic Academy gets more established in more years and people are getting more experience in it. But I mean, I see it as being pretty similar to any of the other fairly successful mid-sized market teams. Like, you know, the one, I think the example I probably bring up the most is probably like a Kansas City. And the difference between Kansas City and Sacramento in terms of what it's going to look like in MLS is that Kansas City is somewhat of an outlier in where its stadium was built, and the fact that even though that stadium is literally in the middle of nowhere, and you know, it's not even in Missouri, right? It's on the Kansas side of the, and I don't know if you've ever been to Kansas City, Kansas, but there's nothing there. And Sacramento's is going to be right downtown in a, you know, hopefully revitalized district that people are going to have access to via public transportation. And but you know, at the same time, I still think the best comparisons would be some combination of like Kansas City, Portland, which I think has the best fan experience in the entire United States. And although we probably don't want to mention them that much in the news right now, I mean, pretty similar to Salt Lake as well.
Yeah, I guess we'll leave that one.
Yeah.
We can leave that one out for now. Yeah, Google that or
yeah.
Twitter that up, I guess. But oof. Yeah, I am very curious about this. And you know, it's a question that maybe doesn't have an answer, or a question that like is just would be challenging for anyone to answer unless they were really in the business of understanding how to build a team and how to market a team and how successful each city can be at it. But yeah, I'm very fascinated by the transition that's going to happen. And
yeah,
definitely seems like the location will be a really, really big deal. The Kings were pretty darn successful in terms of popularity out in, you know, out in the field, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, but they also were the only game in town. Really, you know what I mean?
I think, and I was going to bring them up next, I think that's the Republic have a pretty huge advantage because the bar for what they need to do to succeed is so low, right?
There
I
you
mean,
go.
What do we talk about, like, or what do you hear talk about and when we're not, you know, it's halftime or whatever and media at the games, it's always just like, man, the Kings do not know what they're doing. right? It's just a completely inept organization in so many different ways, right? And all the Republic has to do is like make the playoffs once every 3 years. And that's like the best professional sporting experience that Sacramento's had since, you know, well, I don't really want to bring up like 0102 for all the listeners out there, but I mean, sadly, yes, since the Kings should have won a title. So,
yeah, feel free to bring that up. It's my whole life. I deal with it all the time as a Kings writer, but it's, yeah, I agree. And like, I mean, I don't want to be like a merchant of hot takes, but I really do think that there's a chance it could actually be more successful than the Kings. Obviously that would take a long time of like building that fan base, but just in the long term, I don't think it's crazy. If you have smart ownership and competitive play, I don't think it's crazy at all, especially if you're starting downtown and then thinking about, like you mentioned, youth soccer. I would imagine that like youth soccer is potentially bigger than youth basketball in this area. I don't have any numbers to back that. I'm definitely in speculation city here. Yeah. But, I mean, I know that I just know a lot of people in Sacramento, and everyone played soccer as a kid, and everyone continues to play soccer as a kid. So, and not everybody can be a 5'10 fifth grader or whatever.
Right. No, but that's the trick, right? Is figuring out. I mean, of course, the number one played sport in the United States among youth is soccer, and it's always been the trick is turning, you know, those youth soccer players into soccer fans, because like we as Americans, you know, scoff at anything that's not the best, right? It's like, why am I going to watch MLS when I could watch the Premier League, the Bundesliga, La Liga, right? It has to be the best league or else we're not watching. Everything in this country has to be the best. So why are we going to watch like the 10th best soccer league in the world when we can sit on? So that's the challenge, right? And I think if Sacramento plays their cards right and, you know, has a good amount of success, then yeah, I think you're right. They could be more successful than the Kings. It'll be interesting to see, I guess.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point, and that's definitely a barrier of entry if the play isn't good enough. I mean, obviously the NBA it completely stands alone as the best league in the world. It's not even remotely close. There's only, you know, a few handfuls of players each year at best that turned down the opportunity to play in the NBA. It's really, I mean, some years it's nobody. There's a couple interesting standouts in Spain right now, but generally speaking, if you can play in the NBA, you do, and there's just no question to it. What do you think? So I wanted to try to compare where this is a big question, but trying to compare where like the USL and the MLS kind of would slot in terms of tiers in different countries or in, you know, even top leagues in, you know, not Europe necessarily, but like, you know, South America, those sorts of things. I know it's very difficult question to ask. I don't mean to put you on the spot on so many of these, but from your understanding as someone who definitely, I know, watches soccer in different parts of the world, and like you mentioned, you've attended some games as well. Like, how big are the gaps between the best players in the MLS and like, I don't know, third tier German teams or what have you?
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's an interesting question, and first of all, it's hard to compare because of the like nature of the salary structure in MLS in terms of like, so if you said, look, like, all right, we're going to have an MLS team and you compare them to like a Scottish Premier League team. Okay, well, like the three best players are, when you compare those two teams, are almost always going to be on the MLS team because of the designated player rule and how salary structures work. And then the rest of the squad, I don't know. And so I've probably been to games in maybe 15 different countries, I would say. And I think I get a lot of criticism when I say stuff like this, but I think that it's an issue with perception because people want to just shit on America. I don't know if I can say it on your podcast. Sorry. say bad things, say bad things about American soccer because it's, you know, it's an easy, it's low hanging fruit. It's an easy joke, right? Or whatever. Right. I remember I was in 2013, I was at a Ligue 1 game and it was Lille against literally a team that doesn't exist anymore because they folded. And Lille had just sold Eden Hazard, and they had some good players. Actually, in that game, Solomon Kalou scored a goal, an own goal, and missed a penalty. Interesting. But I just remember thinking, like, this isn't that much better than MLS. And Ligue 1 has grown since then, right? And there's been a lot more cash infused. But I've probably been to 6 or 7 Dutch league games, right? And like the Dutch league, outside of maybe the top 3 or 4 teams, is not better than MLS, right? And LAFC would compete to be one of the best teams in the Dutch league, which is, you know, according to whatever European ranking that you want to go by, is, you know, maybe the 6th, 7th, 8th best league in the world, right? MLS is not that much far behind. What they are far behind in is like depth, right? Outside of the top 13, 14 guys, do you have guys that can really play? Like some teams do. Like you look at LAFC again, I like to use them as an example. Yeah, I mean, like I honestly think LAFC is a team that's good enough to make like the Champions League group stage in Europe, right? Probably won't advance out of their group. It'll be like a situation like I don't see LAFC as being a different team in terms of the quality of players, in terms of the style of play, in terms of what they could do on the field than like a team like Celtic in Scotland, right? And so I think MLS is a lot better than people give it credit for, but also can still has a lot of room to grow. As far as the USL, that's a different story. I remember that's more like I watched a game in Iceland, right? And a top division team in Iceland, probably about the same as a USL team. The league in Iceland, you know, it's only semi-professional, but they play some pretty good soccer over there, and they have probably one of the best youth developments, as has been heavily documented in many publications in the past few years. They have one of the best youth development systems in the whole world. And I would see USL as more of like that level, or, you know, like I've been to a third division game in Germany. I would say that that's probably somewhere between MLS and USL. So it's just, you know, it's so hard to evaluate just because of the differences in culture, the differences of salary structures, like the different types of players that you're getting, the different types of coaches in the league. But I mean, if you want a rough idea of where those leagues stand, in my opinion, which of course could be 100% wrong, that's where I would put them. So, I mean, MLS probably in some way a top 15 league in the world. USL, it would be ambitious for me to put a number, I guess, because there aren't nearly enough leagues of this that would probably be around the same level as the USL that I've actually been able to watch.
Then how big is the gap, like, between the best USL team to like the worst MLS team?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think we've seen a lot in Open Cup matches that could give you a hint. It usually ends up being, you know, like an MLS's reserve team basically taking on the USL team starters, and it's, you know, it seems fairly even. But I think there are certain areas that MLS is much higher quality. Like, I don't think there's a huge difference in like the defensive players necessarily in every game, or maybe even the goalkeepers, right? You know, like you see a lot of guys, like I even look at Thomas Hillard Arce, right? He was a top pick in MLS. He played a couple years and now he's at the Republic, right? Well, but the huge difference I think you see is quality in the final third. I mean, we talk about it all the time. You know, how many chances did the Republic have in that last game against Portland Timbers too, that they just didn't put away?
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's where you see the biggest difference is really like players who are special and who are able to finish off these plays or create something. I mean, again, how often do we watch USL games where we're like, okay, this is some good buildup, but then nothing happens in the final third? But then, of course, because if any player could do something in the final third, then they're going to go straight up to MLS and someone's going to give them a chance. So, I mean, I think with a lot of players, there's not that huge of a difference in terms of, you know, at the back or players who are able to do certain things defensively or athletically. But the real big difference that you do see is attackers.
That's really interesting. Yeah, it's funny how a guy, even like you're just looking at Roro, for example, like yeah. He stands out so much compared to the other guys on the team in terms of like the creativity and the technical skill. And it's just one where like, okay, this guy just looks like he is on a different level. That's very interesting to me. So my first ever soccer article came out today in the Bee. And it's about Sargis, and it's about Hayden Sargis, and it's about how he, you know, it's essentially about how the hope that he can be a bridge player from, you know, bridge this gap from the USL to the MLS, and to be one of the few guys that makes that transition on the team. I mean, hopefully it's more than that, right? But like hopefully it's more than one guy or two guys, but in terms of that improvement that the team as a whole has to make, I mean, you know, what do you think of the odds for some of these guys to carry over?
Yeah, so it's funny you mentioned that. The first thing that came to my mind was that article was written about 3 years ago by Bill Patterson at the Bee, and he was talking about this player named Gabe Gissi, right, who Republic signed as, I believe, a 16-year-old. He came over from the New England Revolution Academy, and he had so much potential. He was like a winger, maybe a second forward, and nothing ever really happened. I'm pretty sure he's playing in the NPSL now, right? But this article has been written just about a different person. But before, you know, we were always so unaware of what the timeline was going to be. You know, people in 2016 or 2015 thought it might happen by 2016, 2017, 2018 or whatever, right? So there's been speculation before. And I will say the one thing I've noticed about Hayden Sargis, and I haven't really gotten a ton of time to evaluate him or look at film or whatever and tell how he is defensively, but he's so good with the ball at his feet and distributing out of the back with both feet, which is something that people value so much in the modern game. And it's almost like, you know, because he can do that, even if he can't defend, which I'm not saying he can't defend, they can teach the defensive part later because he can already do the things that are harder to do, right? And if you watch him, he play like a 60-yard ball on a dime with his left foot. As far as
that's so funny, I like almost that exact sentence is basically in the article.
Okay, I'll have to check it out. I'll have to check it out. I'm sorry, yeah.
It's just funny because you're like what you're saying is like exactly what I was driving at as far as like the creativity that like I mean we just talked about with Roro, right? Like the ability to generate offense, basically with like just a brilliant touch and like a read of the field and the ability to do it from the back. But just in general, like, I'm just thinking, when you in your mind consider this MLS team that was 2022 and now 2023, making it even harder, right? Possibly for more turnover. Like, when you think about that team, are you thinking there will be some carryover, a lot of carryover, or no carryover?
So here's what I will say. If there's more than, like, 4 to 6 guys who carry over from this team to the MLS team, that's a bad sign for the Republic. And that's not based off of, you know, what I necessarily think about these current players or what I think about the players who are going to be there in the future. That's just like, if you look at data from teams who have gone from USL to MLS and the amount of players they've taken with them, Cincinnati took some ridiculous amount of players with them. And they're like, oh, we're going to be good. We have continuity, whatever. They were one of the worst teams in MLS history. In their expansion year, it was not successful. And I mean, obviously there's some other issues at that club as well, but you know, I would hope that the club doesn't take more than that. And if they do, it's like, you know, younger academy guys who, you know, you take a shot on and sign to, you know, one of the development contracts that they have in MLS. So they're, you know, it's a fairly low risk, right? And yeah, you're taking a few guys, but you don't want more than one or two key players coming from the USL to be on the MLS team, because, and I could be wrong, maybe something, you know, crazy will happen and all these players will be fantastic, but based off of, you know, historical data, that would not be a successful team. So I would hope that they well, for their sake, that they have taken a look at that and are looking to make decisions, you know, that seem to be realistic. But you never know. I mean, we talk about the Kings. Don't underestimate a professional sports team's ability to do something really dumb.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. Maybe those guys like Hayden and Mario, who like started at 17 in opening night, like maybe those guys, but it could just be them. That would make sense to me. And you got to hope that it works out and pans out, because how many 16-year-old Americans did we think were gonna, you know, really break through? And then
all of them.
And let's talk about that too. Like, sure. the USA, like we talked about, like USL and MLS compared to some of those other leagues, but like as a nation, right? And I'm sure you've got thoughts on this. I'm like, everyone does. Like, what is specifically the deal with like a really big country with an insane number of resources and an insanely high population just like absolutely failing on the world level? I think who was it that the US like failed to qualify against, like Trinidad and Tobago or something?
You want to hear something messed up?
Yeah.
I was at that game in Trinidad.
Man, so first of all, tell me about that. And secondly, what the hell? Like what's going on?
Yeah. That was one of the weirdest experiences that I've ever had in my life. It didn't feel like a real soccer game. And what's funny about that game is that like there was a player who wasn't even getting minutes for Sac Republic or regular minutes, named Trevin Caesar, who literally played for Trinidad in that game. And I just always think about it. I'm like, dude, the US couldn't beat a team with Trevin Caesar. No, like, you know, ill will towards him. He was fine in USL. He scored like 9 goals one year. But that guy was like made a major contribution to a team that beat the US national team, which should never, that's ever, insane. Ever, ever happen. What's wrong? I've been fortunate enough through my work at NorCal Premier Soccer to, take extended tours and at European coaching academies and do a bunch of coaching education with some of the top minds in the world. And so, like, for instance, I visited Athletic Bilbao, Barcelona, Espanyol, Borussia Dortmund. I've been to Borussia Mönchengladbach, Schalke, Bayer Leverkusen, etc., Ajax, AZ Alkmaar, whatever. The point is that it's a culture thing, I think, and a lot an ego thing and an incentive thing, right? A culture thing in that, like, everything that is done over there is so deliberate. I'm talking like literally you go to AZ Alkmaar, who has probably the best youth academy in the Netherlands, if not the world. And like, they have this training facility where the players have to walk out through for their training games to a tunnel. And on the walls in that tunnel, there are pictures of the AZ first team celebrating to, you know, put in the mind of these young players the idea of teamwork, right? And they're when you go to the, like, I'm not even making this up, when you go to the urinal at AZ Alkmaar, there's literally I don't know how you describe it, but there's a bunch of different colors, right, from like clear to brown, and it tells you how much more water you need to drink based off the color of your pee, right? There's these tiny little details. Like, they have a full-time sports psychologist who creates plans for the players, right? They do video training, they do VR. Like, everything that they do there is designed to get the most out of the players. We don't have that, right? We don't have that culture. We don't have players necessarily watching the game. I've talked to players in MLS, right? I know one player in MLS who I know pretty well, literally doesn't watch soccer, right? Has no idea, right? He's an American player. He's pretty good. He's been playing, I won't say who it is, but he's been playing in the league for about 10 years now. Literally, he doesn't even like soccer, right? And then we also, there's the incentive problem is the part where we have this whole pay-to-play structure, right? So our incentives at the youth game are not to develop players, right? The incentives are for clubs to make money, right? When if the incentive or the pay structure was changed so that like we got solidarity payments and training compensation, then the club, instead of wanting to win games and therefore attract more players because their club has more prestige, would make its money by developing the best players that they can then sell on, right? And that would be a much more successful model that wouldn't prioritize winning and would also allow players who don't have necessarily the means to participate in order, that it would allow them to be able to play. So I think we're missing out on a huge number of players just because it's cost prohibitive. So, I mean, there's a number of different factors. And I think it's getting better. If you look at this generation of players, I mean, we've got like Weston McKennie maybe going to Juventus. I don't know if that's been finalized yet or not. Pulisic was probably the best player at Chelsea this last season. Tyler Adams played in a Champions League semifinal, and he's not American, but Alphonso Davies did come from an MLS academy and won the Champions League. Josh Sargent did fairly well at Werder Bremen. You're seeing a younger generation of players starting to do well. So I think there is a lot of improvement, but at the same time, there's still a long way to go.
Yeah. The structure of the money in world soccer this has been the biggest adjustment for myself, like coming from writing about basketball to mm-hmm. soccer. And I'm still going to be primarily basketball, but like every single franchise in the NBA, it makes a mint, like makes a complete, like makes so much money. You know, the Kings have lost, you know, missed the playoffs 14 years in a row. It's a $1 billion franchise. You know what I mean? They're unfortunately with like, you know, the current circumstances, that might not be the case. They're not like, they might actually lose money for the first time, like ever. Right. The league in general, but in like the Premier League and in like the biggest teams in the world, you just take a bath on those. Like all, from what I've heard, like all these owners just lose money. It's like a vanity project essentially. Yeah. Where there's this, and then like they're spending so much more than they're making, that it's like, is that contributing to that pulling players away from the smaller clubs and making it possible? Like I really got into the Sunderland Till I Die documentary. Love that documentary. And it's like these poor bastards, like they can't compete because they're not willing to lose $50 million this year.
So last year I was in Portugal and I went to go see Benfica, Sporting, Porto and Braga, which are the four biggest teams in Portugal. Amazing experience, amazing country. But through my contacts at work, I had a dinner a couple of times with the Benfica reserve team manager. And I asked him, because this is something I've been thinking about, you know. I said, do you think, you know, in 2004, Jose Mourinho won the Champions League with Porto, right? And I said, do you think that it's possible for a Portuguese team to win the Champions League now? And he said, no, it's impossible. Impossible. And this is like another thing that Europe's great at, is they actually give you honest assessments. Like nobody in America would ever say that about the team they worked for. But I mean, it's just the way that Portugal is not a big enough market. There isn't enough money and they have to be a selling league. Right. And so the dude at the reserve team manager at the biggest club in all of Portugal told me it was impossible for a Portuguese team to ever win the Champions League again. And so, yeah, I mean, like the smaller teams are getting, either priced out or having to adapt to the game in a different way. And a lot of the ways that the smaller clubs are doing that is by improving their youth development system and then, you know, just having the bigger teams buy those players away from them anyway. So, I mean, I think a lot of the spending in soccer is irresponsible, but I guess for a lot of those people, it doesn't matter. And then FIFA tried to institute rules like financial fair play. And clearly like doesn't matter if Manchester City can, you know, get banned, appeal it, win, and then be talked about buying Lionel Messi. Like it's kind of ridiculous in some ways.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. Maybe, you know, maybe you can hope for the MLS that there's, especially for Sacramento, because of what it could do to revitalize downtown mm-hmm. business, that that's appealing enough where, I mean, that's kind of, and again, I'm a super amateur with soccer stuff, but, you know, if you own a club, it can revitalize your other holdings, like basically.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But no, it's going to be weird to see it all play out. And yeah, for I sure. mean, obviously it won't cost nearly as much to be competitive in the MLS than across Europe. But yeah, I mean, we can wrap this up here. I think I've kept you long enough. I really have enjoyed this conversation.
Me too.
Quite a bit, man. I really want to make sure that everyone knows where to find you and where to follow you on Twitter and where to read your work. So let me give it over to you for those places.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, follow me on Twitter at Evan Ream. You know, I got laid off of the newspaper 2 weeks ago, but I still do have a decent amount of stuff up on davisenterprise.com, and I just made a deal with them, so I'm running like one column every 3 weeks. But mostly a lot of the stuff I'm writing right now is either on the NorCal Premier Soccer website, which is norcalpremier.com. I'm doing a lot of just interviews with people who are influential in the game in some way in Northern California, and then you know, I'm doing at least one of those Time Vault columns, but I do a sort of a recap of the events surrounding each game for the Republic on my website, which is just evanream.com. And you know, I basically post on that website whenever I feel like it, whenever there's an interesting topic I want to explore. And I think that's where some of both my best and worst writing has gone. So you can check it out, or you cannot. Either way is good with me.
Yeah, I definitely think everyone should go to evanream.com. Honestly, like, the diversity of stuff on there too, it's been great for someone like myself who's local to Sacramento, wants to read various types of things on soccer. I know you got the Time Vault and then the game notes after the games, but then also, you know, you wrote about the build out line, right? That's what I want personally. That's okay, what I want to read. I mean, that no, I'm not, do not think that I'm representative of everybody, because I'm a huge nerd. I'm like a huge sports nerd, but like, those differences between American youth soccer and youth soccer in Europe, like, that's really fascinating to me. So, yeah, please everybody check out Evan's work, and thanks so much. And everybody, we will talk to you next week.
Thanks, Richard. Appreciate it. It was fun coming on.